Hello and welcome to another episode of the CG Garage. This is episode number 154, which is going to be featuring Max Berman, and I'll get to Max in a second. I just wanted to let you guys know that this is either the last episode or the second to last episode of 2017 of CG Garage, and it's been an absolutely amazing year, and I am recording this podcast intro in my backyard on Christmas Eve in Los Angeles, and I've had an amazing time here. I've gone to a number of conferences this year. I think I've done 70 plus thousand miles of traveling and recorded lots of podcasts from a lot of different people around the world, and it's been absolutely incredible. So thank you so much, and thank you for your support, and I really appreciate you guys being good listeners and appreciating some of the cool things that we've said, and we've got a lot more great podcasts coming up. So I'm really thankful for that. That being said, let's get back to Max. Max Berman is a really interesting person. I met him as a recommendation from Keely Kolklu. As you know, Keely has been on the podcast a couple of times this year alone, and she and I communicate a lot. We seem to really get along in terms of some of the different ideas we have. But Max used to be a friend of hers that she met through her time at PLF, and he's done some work at Kilograph as well. But he's a very, very fascinating person. And what I like the most about him is his entrepreneur spirit. He's started a huge amount of work on his own, decided I'm going to try to start my own business or businesses. And for such a young guy, it's pretty incredible. He has a long family history that several generations in the film industry, which we get into and talk about, and not a lot of people know about that about him. He also started his own visual effects company, and he started a game company as well. He has a great game. We don't talk about it on the podcast, but I checked it out. It's pretty cool. It's a game called Sleep Tight. It's available for the Nintendo Switch. And just go check it out. Go look up Sleep Tight Nintendo Switch. It was really interesting. It's basically looks like the story of a kid in a who sets up forts and a barricade defense system against monsters in his living room and is trying to defend himself against all the monsters that come attack him during the night. And it looks pretty cute and really, really fun. A really smart and fun game he did. But while that was going on, he'd also started another company called Kitbash 3D, which is something that I'm sure all of these listeners of this podcast would be interested in, especially if you're a big 3D artist. So if you guys know what kitbashing is, and you guys know it's about, you know, putting a bunch of stuff together to create a bigger model or to add detail to model, well, he's created architectural style kitbashes in his site called Kitbash 3D. And really go check it out, because there's a lot of great architectural styles that you guys can get and can say, hey, I need to make a background stuff. It's really kind of designed for concept artists, matte painters, people like that. And the cool thing is he's offering everyone a promo code to get 20% off. So if you guys want to go check it out, go to Kitbash3D, K-I-T-B-A-S-H-3D, Kitbash3D, and enter the promo code CG Garage. That is CG Garage, all one word, all lowercase. And you'll get 20% off. So pretty cool. If you guys want a late Christmas present, or you got some money from a relative who gave you a bunch of money and says, here, buy yourself something interesting. Now you know what to do. Go buy yourself some Kitbash stuff. Really cool. All right. I hope you guys enjoyed this really, really fascinating podcast with Max Berman.
Welcome to another CG Garage, where the Chaos Group talks. You'll know it's over when the last bucket drops. We're gonna fire off rays in high dynamic range. We know that ambient occlusion is passe. Global illumination won't lead you astray. And while image-based lighting is really swell, you need to make sure everything has Fernell.
So Keely recommended I talk to you, or said, oh, I had to make a great meeting with this guy Max, who used to work with us for a long time and worked at DD, and he gave a great presentation. You gave a presentation at their office, right?
I did, yeah.
So Tell me a little bit about why she asked you to come to your office and do a presentation.
You know, I don't actually know what what made her call me up for this, but she just, you know, I hadn't talked to her for a while, but of course we always kind of keep track of what everyone's doing. Mm-hmm. And she just hit me up out of the blue and was just like, I hope you're doing well. You know, there's a lot of people here who really love your work, and it would be really cool if you'd come by the office and just give a little presentation and talk about your career and the work you're doing.
Okay. And where did you guys first meet?
We first met at a studio called Pixel Liberation Front.
Yeah, PLF.
Yeah. And we were doing some architectural visualization work there. They were just starting to dip their toe in the water with that kind of stuff.
I didn't realize they were getting into that.
You know, I don't know that much about PLF because I just came in like maybe a year before they were gone. You know?
Okay.
But they started to dip their toe in the water with that, and that's where I met Keely, who then formed Kilograph, as well as the guys over at Cantina Creative.
Mm-hmm.
So it was like this amazing group of people who were at that studio, and then they kind of all broke off and started their own companies that were wildly successful.
Right. Okay. Well, I'm gonna sort of skip back and forth on the story a little bit. So after you were at PLF with Keely, and you stayed there till the end of PLF a little bit, or
you know, honestly, I only did one freelance job for them, but Keely and I just hit it off.
Awesome.
Yeah.
Okay. And then where did you go from PLF?
Well, so PLF wasn't like the first studio I started at.
Right.
Yeah. I started at Zoic and
Zoic. Okay. Of course, I know Zoic. They're right there.
Yeah, a block away from here.
Half a block, I think.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So that's where I started, and PLF was just one of the first people who hired me on when I took the dive into the freelance world.
Okay.
So I left.
How long were you at Zoic?
For a year and a half.
Okay. Yeah. Is that where you started some of your VFX background or stuff?
Yeah, doing matte painting over there.
Okay. Now, from what Keely was telling me, the way that you got into doing CG is from a long family history of doing effects of some kind, right?
Yeah, it's weird. I don't really, not a lot of people know this about me, I guess.
Okay, well, they're about to do it.
Yeah, no, I'm the third generation film industry.
Okay.
Yeah, so my grandpa was a prop maker.
Okay.
And then both of my parents are makeup effects artists.
Okay.
And yeah, so then
what did your grandfather do in props?
Oh, he did like the Wolfman,
you know.
Like,
oh, really?
Yeah, like, you know, old black and white movies.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, and then my dad did the original Planet of the Apes, did the makeup effects.
Oh, seriously?
Yeah.
So who was it? Did he have his own company, or is he working under someone, or who was he working under at that point?
Yeah, actually, my at that time there weren't independent studios, right?
Right.
Everything was under the, you know, Fox.
Right.
But he actually broke off and started the first independent makeup effects studio.
Okay.
So it was called Berman Studios.
Uh-huh.
And that ran for 40 years.
Wow.
And then he just retired about 10 years ago.
So, oh, really? Okay. So for a long 40 years he was doing that. So what kind of, were you involved in that at all?
Yeah, I mean, it's kind of like any family business.
Sure.
You know, you come home from school and go straight to the family store and like help work, you know, work at the shop.
Right.
Growing up, I was always, you know, sculpting and painting and casting and making molds, you know, not well, but as a kid.
That's like a dream for most kids, I'm sure. How was it for you? Because, I mean, sometimes it's like doing work with your dad or your dad's stuff is not always as fun, but for a lot of people, it's like a dream to do that. Huh?
Yeah, you know, it wasn't my passion, I will say. You know, and it was very much, I think it's pretty similar, other than the fact that it's in a cool mask, but it's pretty similar to any kid having to help out at their parents' business.
Right.
You know, it's something you don't want to do, but you kind of have to as a kid.
Uh-huh.
You know, my favorite story about this is I think it was like 8 or 9 years old, and my parents picked me up from school, and they're like, okay, we have to make a bunch of chocolate hands and ears and stuff like that. Like
chocolate?
Yeah, make it out of chocolate.
Okay.
For the show Scrubs.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, and so they had sculpted all this stuff. They had the molds. They had never made anything out of chocolate before.
Okay.
So they were like, we're going to bring it home, and we're just going to melt down all this chocolate, and we're going to pour it into these molds, and we're going to cast it.
Right.
And so, you know, we didn't know anything about chocolate. Clearly, that did not work, because you need a certain amount of wax to hold chocolate together.
Right. Okay.
So all night long, it was my first all-nighter. Uh-huh. And we're working all night, just dumping more and more wax, trying to get them to hold into these shapes and forms. And by the end of the night, I'm sitting there with an airbrush filled with Nesquik, painting these like hands and faces. And the sun came up and it was like 7 a.m. Mm-hmm. And we finally finished. And I was like, okay, I'm going to go to bed. Mm-hmm. And they're like, no, you have to go to school.
Oh my God.
I was like, what do you mean? They're like, well, we got to go to work. So you have to go to school.
Oh my God.
And it was kind of like, that's the kind of training I got. So I felt like growing up, I was trained from day one to be in this industry and to, you know, be comfortable with that kind of crap.
How old did you say you were?
Less than 10 years old.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah. Like, so from an early age.
Oh my God.
I love my parents. They're the most incredible people. But, but yeah, that's the kind of, you know, what I think that just points to the kind of experience of growing up in an industry family.
Wow. Well, that's amazing. To do that, did they turn out okay?
I feel sorry for the actors who had to eat them.
Right, sure, okay. But yeah, that's an amazing story. Just the idea of doing that kind of stuff. But it's interesting that you didn't necessarily feel like you were into it that much, but somehow you still found something that was related that you got into.
Yeah, I think I wanted to carve out my own path.
Okay.
And create something from my own that, like, you know, not always be in the shadow of them. And,
right.
And to do that, it required me to go and find a different industry where, you know, I could take the values that they instilled in me and, mm-hmm. and maybe some of the artistic lessons I took from them.
Right.
But apply it somewhere else.
Yeah. It's interesting because, you know, I've had Matt Winston on this podcast before.
Oh, awesome.
Who's Stan Winston's son,
and
right?
And Stan Winston and my dad were partners.
Really?
Yeah.
I didn't know that.
Way back when. Yeah.
Oh, so you know Matt Winston, probably.
You know, I haven't seen him in forever, but yeah, our families are very closely linked.
So it's interesting because what he's sort of doing is sort of taking, you know, the legacy of his father and turning that into a school. So it's a Stan Winston school. It's an online school. And it's very interesting to sort of teach those effects and things like that. But there is a huge amount of legacy in that world of people just like mechanically trying to figure it out or whatever. Do you feel that obviously you went into the digital world since then and you've carved your own path, as you say, but what did you take besides the lessons that you're going to have to stay up all night? what else do you feel that you take from that or those early days or the lessons you learned from your parents and possibly even your grandfather before you went into that, like to your new vocation? Or,
you know, I think the biggest thing was just work ethic. You know, I was taught that and you know, the thing my grandpa used to tell my dad that he used to tell me is you can't film alibis.
Right. Okay.
And so that's always, I think that's one of the big things that I took over is it doesn't matter what goes wrong. You it doesn't matter what excuses you have. All that matters is what ends up on the screen at the end of the day.
Right, right.
And I think that applies no matter what part of entertainment you're in.
Yeah, it's interesting. I had a conversation with Greg Teagarden where his thing was like, it's going to look great when it's done, which basically is like, yep, it's going to get done some way or another. And you're not going to say, well, you know, I couldn't get it done. Cause like, that's not going to work. So yeah, exactly. I like that. You can't film alibis. So how did you start breaking out? What was the things that motivated you and how did you do that on your own?
Yeah, well, you know, because I wanted to carve out my own path and not have kind of a family legacy looming over me this whole time.
Right.
You know, now 10 years later, I can be comfortable with sharing it. But for the first couple of years, I kept it a big secret of you know, my family past and my background.
Interesting.
And the way I got my first job.
Did you do that specifically because you felt like you want to be recognized for your own work as opposed to your legacy?
Yeah, it was that, and I never wanted anyone to be able to say, oh, you got to where you are because of your parents.
Okay. Yeah. Well, I mean, I don't know if people would do that. I wouldn't do that, but
And you know what? That might be a completely illogical thing, but at the time, at a ripe young age at 18,
that
was kind of the thoughts going through my head. You know, now I can look. I've moved past that a long time ago.
Sure,
but definitely that was the early motivation.
Right.
So how I did that was I went through the phone book and I called every visual effects studio in LA.
But you knew you wanted to do visual effects somehow. Yeah. So what made you want to do that? What did you say? That's what I want to do.
It's a combination. It's first part. I saw The Matrix when I was a kid.
Sure.
That just was the movie that I was like, what is this?
Right.
And they were like, oh, that's CGI. Like, that's what I'm doing.
Right. Yeah.
And then the other thing is when you're working at a makeup effects shop, you're getting fiberglass all inside of you and stuck in you and the chemicals and the acetone and all this stuff. And I was like, no. I don't really want that in my life.
Right.
I'd much rather sit in front of a computer in a much cozier, less poisonous environment.
You know who said? Do you know Kevin Mack?
I don't know Kevin.
Okay, so Kevin Mack. It's not this similar story from you, actually. His dad was a matte painter for like Disney, and like his mother was an ink and paint person at Disney as well, and she. She was the model for Tinkerbell.
Oh my God!
So unfortunately, she passed away this year. Oh. But his dad was very much into that. and him just like you, he would go around on set picking up the set, stuff like that. And he became a practical matte painter, right? So he would do giant physical matte paintings, and he said. He was incredible at it. Apparently did a bunch of the matte paintings on Star Trek and stuff like that. But they were literally painted, airbrushed, and spray cans and stuff. But he said, I was like, I was just so tired of the respirators and the stuff like that. And suddenly there was a computer on the side and I just started learning Houdini. And that's what got me out of being in the model shop. I guess there is a little bit of nostalgia for people, and it's like the model shop is cool, but you don't regret leaving it, do you?
No, I don't. One of my best friends who I grew up with, who was same age as me, and he was working in the shop since he was 14 years old,
right?
And he ended up taking over my parents' shop. Now has his own studio.
Okay,
he's like a brother to me.
Right,
Vincent Van Dyke is his name, and. He was the opposite mindset of he just grabbed it and loved it. And I watched how much he loved it and was like, oh man, I need to find the equivalent of that for myself. And this ain't it.
Oh, that's awesome. That's awesome. But it's cool that you see it. So you say, okay, so I saw The Matrix. That's what I want to do. That's how I'm going to do all these fun things. You still had a passion for films, obviously.
Yeah.
And then you got into, so how did you start learning, on your own or?
Yeah, I was teaching myself just from like, forums at the time.
Mm-hmm.
This is before YouTube. So,
right.
And a lot of Gnomon DVDs, they were big back then. I guess they're still big, but that was my only real resource of like learning.
Yeah. I wrote a couple myself.
Oh, awesome.
Yeah.
I kind of was teaching myself that throughout high school.
Okay.
And then as soon as I graduated, I realized college just wasn't for me. And so I went through the phone book and I called every visual effects studio in the phone book.
Yep.
And just offered to work for free. Just was like, I need to be in a studio. I need to learn what it's like in there.
Mm-hmm.
And the last person on the phone book was Zoic. And they were the only ones who said yes.
Well, yeah, you got to the Z's.
Yeah.
Okay.
But it ended up being the most incredible luck because right as I went in there, this legendary matte painter, Sid Dutton, he closed down his studio, Illusion Arts, and joined Zoic.
Mm-hmm.
And so right when I got in there, he came in and then ended up bringing me on as his apprentice.
Oh, awesome.
And he was, one of the big oil and glass matte painters painter.
Mm-hmm.
So I really got to learn from him and found a mentor right away.
But were you doing it practically too, or were you doing?
No, it was all digital, but he would bring in his old matte paintings and show me his old techniques.
Sure.
Yeah.
Sure. And so you were you matte painting, 2D matte painting at this time, or were you starting to do 3D matte painting?
It was 2D matte painting.
2D matte painting. So you're drawing Photoshop, stuff like that?
Yep.
For how long were you doing that?
You mean before I switched to 3D?
Yeah.
I guess I started incorporating 3D maybe a couple years in.
Okay. So around what year was this? Just so I just got a perspective of what softwares were available to you.
So I started at 2008.
Oh, okay.
It was primarily Lightwave at Zoic, mm-hmm. and then just getting into Maya and Mental Ray.
Yep.
And that's what I had learned for my rendering engine. And then, of course, like a year after I learned it, V-Ray just takes over the entire market. And yeah. I was just like, God damn it. I have to go learn something else.
Yeah. Yeah. But you, well, hopefully V-Ray was able to, you were able to make the brush of V-Ray pretty easily.
Definitely.
Okay. Well, so cool. So then, was that became your specialty, was sort of matte painting at that point, or has that continued to be what you focus on?
Yeah, that's kind of always been my specialty. And you know, through the years, kind of moved more into art direction and done a good amount of VFX supervising as well.
Okay. Wow. That's amazing. And that's a short career to do all of those things. Short. Yeah. That's pretty impressive. But if that becomes an interesting point, because obviously matte painting is a big part of it. You also went to PLF for a short stint, did that gig there. You got in touch with Keeley. I have been trying to find ways to get people to see correlations between different industries, specifically that are involving similar tools, right? Because a lot of people's like, I do VFX, I do ArcVis, or I do architecture, and I do automotive. And there is so much that is in common between what these two people do for those two things that they could learn from each other in a great way. So obviously, when you were working with Keeley and stuff, even though it was a brief time, did you feel that you could learn something new from the ArcVis community or something of that nature?
Yeah, you know, for me, architecture was never like a strong desire for me, but it was always a fun thing to fill the gaps, especially because at that time I was working mostly in television. So you'd have these 3 months in the summer where everything was down.
Right.
But ArcVis doesn't go down.
Right.
So I would fill those gaps with architecture.
Interesting. So were you working at Kilograph a little bit during that time? Or?
Yeah. There was just one summer where I just was doing a bunch of stuff with them. Mm-hmm. But actually cutting to now, just to jump forward a little bit. But,
sure, we can go back and forth. It's fine.
Cool. So I have a company called Kitbash 3D.
Uh-huh, right.
And talking about looking at the values in many different industries,
yeah,
that's one of the things that we're doing.
Okay.
And one of the things that really piqued my interest when chatting with Keeley after all these years and having not seen her for a while, mm-hmm. you know, it kind of lit us up of like, oh my God, architecture is such a giant industry that uses the same exact tools that we use.
Yes.
And so with Kitbash, we're looking at how do we create these kinds of easy, convenient things for architecture or motion graphics or automotive design or all these different things. So that's something that I'm actually interested in right now as well. And I'm trying to look at as many different parallel fields as possible.
Okay. Really, really great subject to go on. And let's go down this rabbit hole. But first, we need to define so that some people may not know what kitbashing means. Yeah. So you're going to have to define kitbash. So why don't you go ahead and give us your explanation of what kitbash is?
Sure. So kitbashing is, from what I understand, mm-hmm. a term from the old model shop days and miniature days. And mm-hmm. what they would do is go and get a bunch of quote-unquote kits. So it would be a model kit as if you were making a they would sell prepackaged kits to make a car or an airplane or all those different things.
Like you get at a model shop and the hobby shops and
exactly.
stuff.
Exactly. Yep. And so kit bashing is taking a bunch of pieces from multiple kits and putting them together to create something new.
Right.
And the most, you know, famous and iconic example is like the Star Wars ships, the Millennium Falcon, which was tons of different kits just glued together and pasted.
That's why
together.
It has all those nernies and detail and stuff like that, right?
Exactly. Yeah, so that's kitbashing.
Okay, and so what is Kitbash 3D? What is your company, and when did you found it, and why?
we launched in September this year.
Oh, awesome! So very recent.
Yeah, it's a very new thing.
Yeah,
we've been working on it for a while, but we just launched.
Okay,
and basically what we do is we sell kits.
Okay,
so you know there's
3D kits,
3D kits.
Virtual kits,
got exactly. It. And, you know, there's a lot of places where you can go get 3D assets, but what we've done is we've tried to find what's the best way to package a kit, you know, a bunch of models that would actually make it perfect for kit bashing, which means you have to figure out a certain, like, the poly count limit of how heavy or dense they are so you can instance them 20 times or whatever, have them all UV'd and set up for tileable textures mm-hmm. so you don't have to go and like, you know, paint texture maps on everything.
Right.
All these different things. And so we're releasing kits every month with different architecture styles.
Oh, interesting.
So either if it's the Gothic kit, you know, mm-hmm. it'll have tons of different archways and doors and towers and, you know, all these different things so that you can create whatever castle you want.
Okay. And so you have different styles of architecture, right?
Yeah.
So This is fascinating because obviously here's an issue I have a lot of times is a lot of people don't necessarily know about architecture styles or architecture influences or why they're useful. The other thing that I think is a shame is, and this is the architect's fault as well, is that there isn't that many people that know specifically about some interesting contemporary architecture that's out there that could be very influential and change the way people see things. Because I think people still, like, for example, like if I play a video game, it's all the same architecture. It's, you know, if especially if it's a first-person shooter, it's all just concrete bunkers everywhere.
Definitely.
With graffiti everywhere. And it's like, okay, well, it's cool. It works for somehow getting a mood, but the mood never changes. There's nothing like, oh, wow, you know, here's a, you know, a deconstruct. I mean, you walk around this area here. You're familiar with it. All this, most of the buildings in this area are designed by Eric Owen Moss, and they're just crazy. No one's ever seen buildings like this.
Yeah, it's stunning. Yeah.
No one's ever seen buildings like this. And they don't even exist in the virtual world because people can't even imagine that style of architecture. And that's the kind of architecture I'd love to see in your kits.
Oh, just wait.
Okay, all right.
Because we have, that's one of the things, you know, at first we needed to cover all of our bases.
Right.
And just get like the things that are coming up the most often.
Right.
You know, like when Art Deco is actually really, really common, even though a lot of people might not realize it. But
sure.
Like when you look at half of these sci-fi films, they're Art Deco. Oh,
well, of course. And, you know, obviously the whole steampunk movement.
Exactly.
Is going to need a lot of Art Deco in it, right?
Exactly. Exactly. So, right. Like, these are these staples that, right. You know, we'll get the Neo Tokyo since that's everywhere. Like, let's hit the
sure.
staples first.
Yeah.
And now that we've kind of, we're building our backlog of all the staple stuff, now we can start to get more creative with, okay, let's find, like, what does utopia look like?
Oh,
and, like, what architects are we going to draw inspiration from? You know, everyone's using the Zaha Hadid stuff,
right.
But like, can we find five other architects that kind of hit that style and do something, a twist on it?
Yeah. Well, there's Eric Owen Moss over there. There's Tom Main is a block and a half that way. And that would be, yes, that would be amazing. And you know, it'd be really amazing because a lot of, especially these contemporary ones, they're still alive.
Oh, yeah.
And so they may be able to supply you with some influence and they'll all work digitally.
Yeah. Can I tell you my dream with Kitbash?
Okay, please.
And it's not an architect, but my dream is to have Sid Mead design a kit.
Right.
That's and to get people of that caliber and that legacy to be.
I bet you could. That's a good idea. I mean, if he just draws a bunch of kit ideas,
we'll build
you'll build the
up.
Whole thing, and you know he would get a commission on the Sid Mead
exactly.
legacy, and it would be my gosh, that would be really cool.
So that's really our vision and where we're pushing towards.
I wonder if you'd do that. Because I wonder, it's like, oh, they're just ripping me off. Well, no, you're getting paid every time they rip you off.
Exactly.
That's a brilliant idea.
Thanks.
I really like this. I don't know. I mean, I'd have to think about what people would think. I would be really curious from the listeners to think of like, what if like Frank Gehry, as another example, mm-hmm. we basically said, here's the Frank Gehry Kitbash kit, you know, or Michael Graves, for God's sake. You just go to Target, there's all this Michael Graves, like, you know, toilet bowl cleaners because
yeah.
they have this beautiful method design, whatever it is. That was designed by an architect. Yeah, okay. Yeah, I think you've got some really great ideas there.
Thanks.
Really cool. Really cool. All right. So how does your site work?
Yeah. So, I mean, it's for personal use. You just go on there. And
so it's like it's like many of the other asset gathering places, right?
Yeah, it's like any other 3D asset store.
Okay, and then when you buy a kit, how many does it like? Oh, here's 150 pieces or 200 pieces, or how does it? What does a kit look like?
Yeah, so the pieces change depending on the style because
sure, of course.
Yeah, Neo Tokyo is going to have a different amount of pieces because they're not going to be maybe as tiny of pieces as like Gothic.
Right.
So all these things change, but so what we try to do it by is the poly count.
Okay.
And so every piece is around 30,000 to 50,000 polys,
mm-hmm.
and every kit is between 2 and 3 million polys.
Okay.
So you're looking at around 50, you know, some are higher, some are lower mm-hmm. poly counts, but you're looking around 50 pieces per kit.
Mm-hmm.
But with that, we also try to design it so that, you know, if you have a building, we're going to make every facade of it something interesting so you can rotate that and get 4 different buildings out of it.
Right, okay? Of course.
So, yeah, that's kind of the way we package it. And, mm-hmm. you know, it's not like this is the exact number of pieces and this is the exact poly count for all of them.
Right.
It's more like, we're going to curate this.
And do you guys provide textures too?
No, but we set up everything for tileable textures.
Okay.
Yeah.
So, all right. So that's, and obviously, so people still have to put their textures on and their own shaders and stuff like that, right?
Yeah. But we try to make it as drag and drop as possible.
Of course.
Yeah.
Okay. Are you thinking of expanding into those areas and thinking about doing some textures and some shaders? And...
We're definitely looking at it. Yeah.
Okay.
The hard thing with shaders is there's so many different like softwares and render engines. Mm-hmm. So to create a shader that works for everyone across the board is a little more difficult than creating an OBJ.
You're right. I mean, like TurboSquid is pretty much just put V-Ray on everything because they know they can hit almost market on that. but there are other ways of looking at it where you can influence different renderers. And one of the things is MDL materials. Have you heard of MDLs?
So I have not.
MDLs are is NVIDIA's answer to a more universal material file system. So if any renderer that supports MDL, and many of them do, will all render the same shader.
Oh, wow.
So that's a way to sort of look at that. It's very new, so it's not like not a lot of people know about it. Obviously, like you don't know about it.
Yeah.
But ultimately, that could become like the FBX of materials in a sense. You know what I mean?
That's amazing.
Yeah.
Awesome.
So that's something to think about. But yeah, I love this idea. I think so you said you launched it in September, which was just a few months ago.
Yeah.
But how long have you been planning this?
You know, I've been thinking about it for a long time.
Okay.
But I was always so busy on a million other things. Mm-hmm. And I mean, basically we kicked it off in June.
Okay.
It was kind of like another plan I had got pushed. Something else I've been working on got delayed, and I have like a whole team set up to do the marketing for. I made a video game. So I had a video game, and it was going to come out in September, and we got pushed because of the release date conflicted with something else.
Okay.
And I had this whole marketing team lined up to market this video game. And I was like, oh, shit, what do I do with this whole team?
Right.
And me and my partner at Kitbash, we were like, well, fuck it. Let's do something else. And I was like, I've had this idea for this like kit thing.
Right.
Like, how long would it take to put together? Let's just like go for it and try to release this in September.
Okay.
And we did. And it's just been like, now it's our full focus. It's been a wild ride. Yeah.
How much attention have you guys gotten for it?
I mean, it's been huge. We've been throwing contests. You know, we give sample kits, free sample kits.
Uh-huh.
And we say, if you make an image with the sample kit and post it, we'll give the top 10 paintings a free kit.
Oh, right.
And so we've had 300 entries into the contest.
Oh, wow.
I mean, the site's gotten like 40,000 hits. Like, I mean, it's been growing and growing month after month. It's definitely not like boom, we're like, you know.
Right, yeah, no, but it's getting a lot of attention.
But it's moving forward, and a lot of great studios are picking up studio licenses for it. And so it's been growing and growing, and you know, we're doing a live stream tournament next week.
Oh, wow.
So we've just been like...
Can put it on Twitch or something?
Yeah, it's 10 days on Twitch every day, live head-to-head battles between people. It's pretty much Iron Chef meets concept art.
Oh, no.
So, yeah, we've just been having so much fun with it, and it keeps growing and growing. So, it's just a fun thing.
That's pretty cool. That's awesome. So you've been doing a lot. They said you were doing a video game too?
You have a game coming out with Nintendo in February.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
And how long you been working on that?
2 years.
2 years?
Yeah.
How? Okay. And that's from your own company as well?
Yeah. That's just, I'm a solo dev, and I've hired out a lot of artists, but I've been just making this.
Okay. But you worked at DD too. Like you've been all over the place then.
Yeah. You know, and I'm still doing client work. Like,
Wow.
Yeah. I still do, you know, a couple projects for Blur every month.
Okay. And mostly concept art, or are you doing matte paintings?
And matte painting.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah.
Wow. That's pretty cool. So you said you live around here in Culver City, so Blur is right next door. So that's pretty easy.
Yeah. Yeah. And I love those guys. It's no matter how busy I get, every time they call me, I'm like, I can't say no to you guys. Cause they're
fun.
Too cool.
Yeah. They're really fun. Really fun. But you worked at DD a little bit. I guess you and I were at DD at the same time. We just never worked together. Right.
Yeah. We always cross paths on the hallway, but it's like one of those things where you're like, I don't know his name. And now we've seen each other too many times.
Yeah. Yeah. I know exactly what you mean. Hey, what's up? guy.
Yeah.
So, but you were on a couple really cool projects there. Obviously, you were on the Iron Man project when you were there, which was pretty really cool. What you do there with the what was it? The one with the catching the plane thing?
Yeah, the Barrel of Monkeys.
The Barrel of Monkeys. That's what it was called. Yeah. When he's trying to catch all those people falling out of the airplane. Pretty crazy. So what were you doing on that?
I was at DD doing matte paintings for it.
And, okay.
Yeah.
And then you worked on Her too, right?
Yeah.
I think it's a highly underrated work by Digital Domain and, you know, what Janelle did, because people don't really talk about the CG in this thing, but there's a ton of CG.
Yeah.
And so were you doing all the futurizing Los Angeles kind of look to it?
Yeah.
Okay, because that was pretty amazing. Because for those of you who haven't seen the film, it's obviously, who is it?
Spike Jones
is the director, and
Joaquin Phoenix
is the main actor, and he's basically a guy who gets a new computer, which is basically, he basically falls in love with Alexa.
Yeah, completely.
And so it's a computer, it's in your house, et cetera, et cetera. But it takes place in the near future, and so a lot of it is just showing Los Angeles, but Los Angeles has evolved and changed, and there's more buildings in there, and just slightly futurized everything, which is interesting. Because when did you do that? That was like maybe 4 or 5 years ago?
Maybe 2013 or 14.
Okay. Yeah. Okay. So if you go and look at that Los Angeles now, and all the buildings being built, it looks like whatever you did for that film is actually happening, because there's so much building going on in downtown LA right now.
Yeah.
So I found that that's really cool. But it was really, really great work. And it was really kind of invisible in a lot of ways.
Thank you. I always tell people that's my favorite project I was ever on.
Really?
Yeah. By far my favorite.
Yeah, Janelle's really cool. She's been on the podcast too.
I love Janelle.
She's really, really smart. She's got a great eye, and she really can. She can work with some great, great directors. Obviously, Spike Jonze is incredible. Did you get to meet him, or
I didn't know? It was an interesting time working on that movie, because it was right when DD Venice was wrapping up and closing the doors.
Yep, that was right when I was leaving. So
gotcha.
Right.
So when I got in there for that job, I finished Iron Man, did some freelance work, and then jumped back to DD mm-hmm. for Her. And Iron Man, it was like, I think Oblivion was going on and Ender's Game. So it was just like hundreds of people. The studio was busy and packed.
Mm-hmm.
And then when I got there for Her, that was, I think, the only movie going on at the time.
Right.
And
could have been.
There were 10 of us on it.
Mm-hmm.
In total.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember, you know, it was maybe we had 2 months left before they closed the door.
Right.
And I showed up and my keyboard wasn't working on my computer.
Yeah.
And I was like, who do I call for like a new keyboard? Mm-hmm. Like, we were all in one little area. They're like, we don't really have tech support anymore. I was like, oh, okay. What do I do? They're like, go to the keyboard graveyard. I was like, what? And they had a cubicle that was just stacked to the brim with all the keyboards of the studio.
Yep. I've been there.
Yeah. It's just like grabbed two of them. The second one worked. It's like, oh, I guess this is just how the project's going to be.
Yeah.
And it was just kind of this like ragtag, you know, it was this amazing group of artists, but you're kind of working in this studio that's kind of dead.
Because I guess everyone else had already kind of moved to Playa at that point, and you were the last ones there.
Yeah.
That was kind of weird.
So we were kind of all just like savoring it. Mm-hmm. Like, you know, that studio was such an amazing place to be.
Oh, yeah.
And so to be that last little crew left with the lights on was just like, okay, you know, let's just, you know, take in every moment of this.
One of my, you know, it's funny. It's two things I can think of about that Venice location, because you look at it from outside, it doesn't look that great.
Mm-mm.
It doesn't look good at all. It looks better now because Google bought it, but it
looks even worse from the street in the back.
Oh, yeah. Absolutely. But I was walking down the street one day. This is years ago. I was walking down the street with a couple other DD guys, and we were about to get into the building, and there was this homeless guy who was walking around with a shopping cart, you know, with all his crap in there and whatever. And a nice guy, and he looked at us and said, hey, guys, do you know what this building is over here? And he says, oh, that's Digital Domain. It's a major visual effects facility in the movie industry. And he goes, oh, man, what a dump.
Yeah.
Oh my god!
I was like, "Yep, yeah, it's about right. It's about right." But it was cool. You know, it's funny because when I started there, obviously I came from Gensler, and Gensler is like very nice, well put together furniture. Everything looks beautiful. You know, it's really one of the best architecture or biggest architecture firms in the world. And then I come to DD, and I'm like, I think I just walked into a frat house.
Oh, yeah, completely.
Yeah, it was pretty funny. And speaking of that architecture, or the architecture, the keyboard graveyard, I remember finding that thing, and I was like, what's all these keyboards? It's like, oh, you can grab one if you want. You know, these are all just old keyboards. And I found an old SGI keyboard in there, and I connected it to my computer, and it still worked. And it was so loud. As I was typing, you could hear me type for like the entire warehouse. It was pretty funny. But yeah, it was cool that you were part of that last group to see that place. So it seems like actually after you're talking about PLF too, you're like one of the last groups in that area too.
Yeah, maybe I'm just bad luck.
No, I don't know if you're bad luck. You get to see those. You get to witness those moments, which I think is really cool.
Yeah, definitely.
So all right. So you've got obviously your Kitbash 3D thing going on, which sounds amazing. You've done video games. You're still doing map paintings. Is there any other things that you've been doing that are interesting we can talk about?
Well, you know, I think right now I love map painting and I love art, but I'm really trying to make a switch. So I'm really trying to go more on the business side of things.
Okay.
I just have fallen in love with business, which is a very weird thing for an
artist. What got you into business?
So shortly after DD, when all the studios closed, I went up to Vancouver as everyone had to.
Yeah.
And I did a couple films up there, and the winter alone, I was just like, screw this. I'm a California pussy.
Right.
I need to be in LA.
Right.
And just being away from all my friends and family, I was just, you know, it's not worth it anymore.
Right.
And I came back and I opened up a studio.
Okay.
And was doing a bunch of commercial work and just running.
How did you open your studio? Did you just open it out of your house or did you rent a space? Or?
Yeah, I rented a space.
Okay.
And I had a partner who was a EP.
Okay.
And so, you know, the two of us got this space up and running and got in some artists and started bringing in projects. And we ran it for about 2 years. And in that time, you know, he handled all the business and I was handling the art.
Mm-hmm.
And it was, we just did bad business.
Okay.
And you know, while we were super busy and always had work coming in, you know, I started to learn how bad of a business model really running a visual effects studio is.
It's terrible.
It's the worst business model in the world.
Yeah, no, it's absolutely terrible. You're right. Yeah.
So after seeing that, you know, eventually we were just like, this isn't worth it.
Right.
We closed down the doors and I started back doing just art for different studios.
Mm-hmm.
But once we closed that down, I started studying business to be like, what the hell is going, like, how is this even possible? Like,
right.
If you're going to run a business, like, let me learn what that is first.
Cause
I've felt like I wanted to do something more than just painting for people forever.
Right.
And so I just studied it for a couple of years and started to really fall in love with the creative aspects of business.
So what research, okay. So I'm sure there's a lot of people who want to know, start their own businesses or do things. In fact, that was actually a theme. I was at Trojan Horse was a Unicorn, which is an awesome conference in Portugal. And they had one of the series of talks was, you know, was the business side of creative process. What are the resources that people can use that like you did, or what resources did you use to learn about that, the creative business thing?
Yeah, well, you know, one of the great things about being an artist in this industry is you can always be listening to a podcast or something in the background.
Yep.
So that means that the whole time you're getting paid to work, you can be ingesting knowledge.
Right.
And that's very few other professions get to do that.
Yes.
So for me, that was what I took advantage of. It's like, okay, I'm going to be painting here for 100 hours a week. Let me plow through every audiobook I possibly can.
Yes.
Every YouTube lecture series interview with any major CEO or entrepreneur.
Yeah.
And then just reading and a ton of reading. Mm-hmm. And you know, what I would say to people who are interested in business is first find great business people and listen to every interview they have.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like if you're watching TV, watch Shark Tank.
Right.
Like it actually will teach you quite a bit about like valuations and like profit margins and all that stuff. You know, people like Tony Robbins or Gary Vaynerchuk.
Okay.
And that kind of led me into learning about marketing, which is in my opinion, the most important part of business.
Yes. If no one knows what you're doing, then
it doesn't matter.
It doesn't matter.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So those were kind of the resources and how I was studying up and training.
What were some of your favorite resources?
I would definitely say Gary Vaynerchuk. If you don't know him, he's a masterful business person and a masterful like marketing.
And what, does he have a book or podcast or both?
He has three books, which are all great. Mm-hmm. Jab, Jab, Right Hook, The Thank You Economy, and I forgot his last book.
Okay.
But he has three books and he has a great YouTube channel where he does, he has a show called Ask Gary V.
Okay.
Where different businesses call him up and ask, like, how do I get my product in front of customers? And he always has some cool, like, this is what you do.
Oh, interesting.
So he's definitely my, like, number one recommendation.
Interesting. Yeah. And what about marketing?
That's for marketing.
That's for marketing.
Yeah.
Interesting.
Yeah.
I'm going to look it up because I forgot the guy's name. And the title of the book is horrible. But hold on, just give me a second here. But the guy I work with, Lon, he told me to read this book when I kind of started in this business, and I was like, oh, Joe Pulizzi, Pulizzi, and he wrote a book called, and it's the worst title. It's called Epic Content Marketing, and it's what was interesting about that. What I learned the most about that is that direct marketing and content marketing are two different things.
Mm.
And really, like the biggest example I could use from what you just showed me is, or we were just telling me about, is like getting people to do the contest, right? Or to say, hey, we'll give a prize to this. Because what you're doing is you're getting people to get excited about your product and creating marketing material virtually for free. Right? There's incentivized. I mean, you're certainly not ripping them off,
mm-hmm.
but you're incentivizing them and you're basically creating a buzz and content and people coming to you as a resource. And that became a really important thing for me. Like, actually, you know, you can just listen to this podcast. It's like, why am I doing a podcast? Like, people come to this all the time and listen to what I have to say. I rarely talk about V-Ray,
mm-hmm.
but it's a resource for people to come to. And they're like, oh, okay. So if people keep coming to the podcast, they'll be looking at a bunch of stuff. I'm not sitting here telling you about like buying V-Ray this, I never say that usually. So that's something that I think is fascinating, is creating the marketing that I learned recently is marketing is not about brochures and banner ads and that kind of stuff. It's mm-hmm. about providing good marketing provides really good learning material and resources for everyone to look for.
Yeah. So, I totally agree. I'm going to have to check out that book.
Yeah.
One of the things that we've been going after in Kitbash is how do we give people so much, give them so much value, whether or not that's spotlighting them and giving them a platform so that we can share their name and their work with our audience at large,
yep.
giving them free sample kits, doing these big competitions and festivals mm-hmm. and connecting them with artists that they admire
mm-hmm.
and doing all of that. And we want to give them so much that when we release a new kit, they feel almost guilty to not buy it.
Right.
You know, because of how much we're giving them. And we always want to give way more than we ask of them.
Right.
And so that's really what our entire strategy with Kitbash has been.
Right.
Yeah.
But the thing is also, if you associate yourself with really great artists, right, giving that person, or if I give a really great artist a license of V-Ray, say, hey, we want you to try new stuff. One, we'll get great feedback.
Yeah.
If it's a good artist, right? And then when content is made out of that and is like, I bet you I could sell 100 copies of your Kitbash based on the fact that this guy did a really great job.
Yeah, exactly.
You know what I mean? So it's totally worth it.
Yeah. Influencer marketing is huge now.
Right.
Yeah.
And so those make a huge difference. And you really didn't – you didn't really lose money by giving that. You just lost the opportunity to him not to buy it. And
yeah.
there's no guarantee, or her not to buy it. And there's no guarantee that person would buy or not buy it.
And if they fall in love with one kit, they might get one in the future.
Right. And right? then they continue a relationship with you and forever, or give you ideas for new kits.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, I mean, marketing and business has been something I've been studying for like the last 2 years, and I've fallen in love with it. And
right.
and because of that, I found a great partner in Kitbash. His name is Banks Boutte.
Okay.
And the two of us.
Where did you guys meet?
you know, he was directing a commercial I was VFX supervising like 6 or 7 years ago.
Interesting.
Yeah, long time ago.
Where was that?
Just independent.
Yeah. Oh, independent. Okay.
Yeah. Yeah. So we met a long time ago, but we recently got reconnected and we just were like, oh, we have the same kind of mindset on business and marketing and life and philosophy and all these things. And we were like, we got to do something. And so that's why, you know, we're publishing my game, we're creating Kitbash, and we've started our actual marketing company that handles those things.
Okay.
Yeah.
Wow. That's amazing that you've done all of that. it's such an incredible thing.
Thanks.
If people want to start saying, it's like, okay, I have an idea for something like similar to you, where you say, you know, because I think there's a lot of people like us that have been in the visual effects industry or something that for some reason or another can't continue to sort of really be involved with it like the used to be in the old days, where it was like, we need to branch out, we need to do something else. So let's say person X here says, I've got a really great idea based on all the things I've learned in my visual effects background to do something. Let's just say for VR, because that's pretty much what most of the people are doing right now.
Yeah, yeah.
So what are some of the ways, the steps that you've taken that you would, if someone say, hey, I've got this VR idea, how am I going to start a business? What am I going to do? So what would you advise them to do?
I would say you'll never accomplish anything if you don't have action steps.
Action steps. Okay.
Yeah. If you want to create this VR company or this VR piece,
right,
that's a loose idea right now, unless you actually have your plan of like, in order to accomplish this, I need to do step 1, 2, 3, 4, 5.
Right.
If you can't see the steps to get to that,
right,
go and research until you can figure out what those steps are.
And those are going to be different for every business, you think?
Yeah, completely. Okay. I think so.
All right.
Making a video game versus making a kit are very different steps.
Absolutely. But you got that Kitbash thing done pretty quickly, though.
Yeah, we did. We did. So for me, I would say what I try to do when I want to accomplish something, I find the steps and then I try to
break. And you come that out in a business plan of some sort, or?
I like lists. I'm a to-do list kind of guy.
Okay.
So that's my like overall to-do list to get to the end goal.
Okay.
And that lets me break it down into small chunks.
Okay.
And because, you know, maybe this idea of creating this big VR experience could be almost overwhelming at times, like, oh God, how do I, there's so many moving parts.
Right.
But if you can break that down into smaller steps, then they start to become more accomplishable.
Right.
And then from there, what I try to do is I have my milestones of like, I need to take one step forward every day.
Okay.
And as long as I'm every day pushing the ball forward, and anytime an obstacle comes up, I'm just going to keep pushing forward. It doesn't matter.
Right.
And I think that's the part of why most people don't cross the finish line with these things is because an obstacle comes up. Maybe it's not in the beginning. Maybe in the beginning they roll right over them. Mm-hmm. But as you get closer and closer to the end, those obstacles get bigger and bigger and they get harder and harder to push through.
Right.
And I really think it's just that follow through of like not stopping until you like get past all of your steps and get to that finish line.
But I think the other thing that's can happen sometimes is, especially let's say you're doing something that's cutting edge or whatever, right? Is you do lists, which is a good thing, but a lot of people may get distracted and sort of deviate from
completely.
That list, right? And they're like, oh, look, let's go down this rabbit hole. And suddenly like, what have I been doing 3 months? I've been looking at this thing and it has nothing to do with my actual plan. And I'm not off the thing. So that's another problem. Yeah, right?
Hardcore focus.
Right.
Yeah. Which is even a problem for us because, I mean, we have so many moving pieces going on with, you know, at first we were just going to publish a game and now we're running, you know, three companies of like a marketing company, a kit company, and this game company.
So what's your marketing company do?
It's called Fuzzy.
Okay. I like it.
And it's purely our internal company. So
it's a company that's supporting your other companies.
Exactly.
As marketing.
We realized that this was the most important piece of the puzzle for us, because I can make things, but if I can't put them in front of a consumer, then it doesn't matter.
Right.
And we realized if we built Fuzzy and we've built the team around it, built the pipeline from it, then we could plug anything into the top and connect it with its customer, regardless of who that customer is.
Okay.
So once we had that infrastructure built, that's how we were able to get Kitbash out in 3 months.
Right.
Was because we already had the infrastructure.
Right.
And so same thing with this game that we're, you know, we're plugging it right through our same infrastructure.
Right.
And that also means that because we now have this built, that next year we can continue to develop ideas, plug it through the, you know, through Fuzzy.
Right.
And let it hit its customers.
And you can do a completely different idea.
Doesn't have to be even within the same industry.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's pretty interesting.
Yeah.
Yeah. Cause I just based on what you were talking about, Kitbash is like, I see that, but I already see like way more offerings in there.
Yeah, you know the 10 steps down the road when you just
totally
look at it.
See it. Yeah. I mean, you're basically like Amazon, like we're going to sell books. But eventually you're going to sell everything through that store. I can definitely see that where it just influences all kinds of stuff because digital media is going to be huge.
Yeah.
Kitbash is a great place to start because it allows for creativity, right? So it's like I can be creative faster because I don't have to model everything, right? So that's the whole influence of it. But creating digital content is going to be a huge deal. It already is, but it's going to be a massive economy in this area. I really believe that.
Easier barrier to entry with Kitbash. That's what we saw is that if you don't know 3D, if you're a 2D artist, let's say, or even you're a director who comes from a practical side of things and doesn't know visual effects, but now you want to start making VR pieces.
Yep.
Well, are you going to sit down and learn modeling?
No.
Yeah. So, but are you going to, you can come to Kitbash and like, oh, I want to do this sci-fi piece. Let me grab the Neo Tokyo or like Apocalyptic. I'll just grab Warzone.
Right.
And now I have my pieces and I can start to just block in the set and create the story I want in almost instantly.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. While we're on the subject of books, because I'm gonna keep emailing you every idea of cool books, and I want you to do the same for me.
Yes, definitely.
Okay, I've been reading. I'm still reading right now. I'm almost at the end of it. It's amazing. It's by Kevin Kelly.
Kevin Kelly
is one of the founders of Wired magazine way back.
Oh wow.
Okay. And he's writing a book called, I'm gonna get the whole title on this, The Inevitable, and understanding the 12 technological forces that will shape our future. And it's about, it's stuff that, I'll just put it this way, you and I and most of my listeners probably know a lot of this, but he connects the dots in such an amazing way that's incredible. Basically saying, it is inevitable that VR will happen. When it does, this is what's going to happen. And this is what's going to happen. And that's going to happen. Or like just the amount of data that we're going to create or the fact that we're tracking everything we do. And all of these influences, like AI is inevitable. And is it bad? Yeah, probably. But we're still going to, the benefits are going to outweigh the negativity, just like the internet, right?
Yeah.
Like when .com came along, I was like, this is the worst thing ever. It's like, yeah. I think we can't live without it right now. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So it's he draws parallels on things that have happened in the past and like where is it going to go in the future. And he says, today we take this for granted. Imagine if we go back 20 years, we'll say that would never happen. Well, it did happen, right? As an example, he talks about Wikipedia, right? Mm. And no one would ever have thought that the world's biggest encyclopedia was written by everyone in the world.
Oh, yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
No, they would think, no, you have to have scholars and people that really know the subject. Right? It's like, nope, anyone can write it. And anyone can change it at any point in time. Yet it is the major resource for everyone to do, and it balances itself out. So it's a fascinating book. But he does mention also the enormous amount of content that will be virtual, that will not necessarily exist in the real world. Mm. And things like Kitbash and whatever else Kitbash becomes in the future, those places will be building them or allowing people to build them, right?
Yeah, we want to be the Home Depot of digital assets, right?
There you go.
Yeah.
Perfect. I love that idea. That's really, really cool.
Actually, on that note for that book, have you heard of the book How We Got to Now?
No, that sounds really good.
Oh, it's great. I don't know the author off the top of my head.
Okay, we're putting it. Well, all of these will go in the show notes, but
it's six technological breakthroughs that changed the world.
Yes,
and he whittles it down to the six times where when this happened, everything changed.
Okay,
and the things are very like you don't see the cause of effect until you really look at them from a really like far away lens.
Okay, give me an example of one.
Like I think chapter two is like ice. So when we were able to transport ice.
Right.
Everything in the world changed.
Of course.
Yeah. And not only was it like, okay, now we can control certain amounts of temperature around the world, or we can ship meats and foods around.
Right.
But then that directly led into air conditioning.
Right.
And air conditioning is one of the things that pretty much killed off, you know, a lot of the malaria and things like that was happening in like the, you know, the Central Americas.
Right.
So it's these like little tweaks that happen that change everything. Glass is another one. As soon as we were able to manipulate glass, was the first time we were able to make mirrors. It's the first time we could see ourselves. And, you know, these things where you're like, oh, everything changes.
Yeah, everything changes. Yeah. That's amazing.
It's a great book that kind of makes you think of everything from a much wider lens than we're used to looking at.
Right. And then, you know, the whole... I was talking about it specifically. I remember when, you know, the internet was coming along, and a lot of people, the older people, were like, I don't understand this internet thing. What's it for? And one of the examples I was that we were watching a TV commercial. My mom, this is in the, I guess, mid-90s. And it was like, go to Ford.com for more information or something like that. You know, Ford.com was on the bottom. Mm-hmm. Or it didn't even say that. It just had Ford.com on the bottom of the banner. And my mother said, why would I, what is it, Ford.com? Why would I go there? And I said, eventually you won't even need a TV. If you want to know about a car, you're going to go there. And you'll know everything about the car. And it's like, you'll know everything about the car you'll ever need before you even go to the dealership. Which is like, what? You know, because they were still in the mentality, I go to the dealership, I pick up a brochure or three or 10, and I talk to a salesman who's going to deliver a bunch of weird information to me, no discernible information, that everything will be on the internet. And it seemed like no one would thought, like back then in the early 90s, I was like, yeah, maybe. But now it's like the norm, right?
So, yeah. Which is funny because I think our parents' generation still goes to the dealership and picks up the brochure.
Sure. Have you tried to go to a dealership and pick up a brochure? They don't have them anymore. They're like, oh, do we?
Really?
No, it's really hard to find a brochure at a dealership.
Huh. Well, after Tesla, I feel like it's going to be pretty hard to find a dealership soon.
Yeah, that's a good thing. yeah. That's a good thing, yeah. The whole sales model of cars was just doesn't make any sense anymore at all. Yeah, well, that's amazing. So I'm fascinated by what you're doing. I'm fascinated by the fact that you got so involved in business and can be that. I actually think and I should put you in touch with some people that you could be a big proponent to speak about this, like about the business side of things, because if you're going to be successful, it sounds like you're going to be very successful. I think the creative industry needs more voices like yours to talk about how to, because we're so bad at business generally.
Yeah. Oh yeah.
And we need more people like you that can say, okay, here's what I've learned. Here's how to get over this. And you know how they actually are, because business people don't understand creative people a lot of times. But if you can influence that bar, it'd be really cool.
Yeah, I would love that. I went to my first conference this year at IFCC in Croatia and talked about business.
Okay.
And it was like one of the most amazing experiences just to go there and to meet so many like peers that you know of, or you know their work, but you've never met in person, and you're just instantly friends.
Right.
But also to just go speak about that kind of stuff. I do feel like, you know, I've learned this stuff from spending 10 years making every single mistake in the book.
Yeah.
And I'm finally getting fed up enough with it to go down, sit down and study it and then practice it.
Right. Well, that's how you learn.
Exactly. Yeah. you know, I love doing that, and it's definitely one of my missions is to be a strong proponent in trying to teach creative people how to take care of themselves in a business sense, because this is an international market and no one else is taking care of you.
Right.
So you kind of got to be trained up to take care of yourself.
Yeah. Yeah, and people are creating content constantly. They don't realize how to put it out there, how to sell it, how to market it. And I think there's a lot of people that can do that. I think Alan McKay is doing a really good job in his podcast talking about how to market yourself. But just starting a business and having an idea and like, I got an idea. How do we do this? That's something I think would be It's really cool. Well, this has been awesome. We're wrapping right up here. We're exactly an hour. So I really appreciate you coming by and talking about this stuff. Fascinating. Keely was 100% correct that you should be on the podcast. So I will be thanking her and emailing her soon. But yeah, this has been great, Max. I really, really appreciate your time.
Chris, it's been an absolute pleasure.
All right. Well, thanks so much. And then we'll make sure that everyone in the show notes will have links to your site so they can check out all the things you're doing. We'll put all the books that we've recommended in there as well so people can look at that. But it also sounds like it's going to be a great resource for people to just grab a bunch of KitPatch stuff and start seeing how they can change their designs and their environment.
Yeah. All right. Awesome. Thank you.
Thank you.